Hey everyone, I recently had a chance to chat with the director of the AI doc, or How I Became an Apocalypse Optimist, which is a great AI documentary. I talked about it before, and I recommend you check it out in theaters when you can, or when it's on video on demand. But yeah, I had a chance to chat with Daniel Rohr, the Oscar-winning director behind Navalny, about this film and about his broader thoughts around AI, and I think we had a really good conversation. So this is honestly a good chat, even if you haven't seen the film, but if you've seen it, it's sort of like a behind-the-scenes look into his thinking process and his deeper thoughts about AI, and certainly how he thinks about AI now that he's actually finished the film, and there's been a lot of news about it since that. So yeah, take a look at the film if you can, and here's our chat. Daniel Rohr, thank you so much for joining us in the Engadget podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'd love to know what led you to make the AI doc, because it feels like a very different movie for you. Like, I saw Navalny. I love Navalny. I know you've covered all sorts of different topics, including like a band and things like that. But what interested you in the story around AI? Is it just the fact that it seems like it's going to have a really serious effect on the future and we just don't quite have a handle on it right now?
Well, first and foremost, thank you so much for having me. Appreciate your interest in the film. I wanted to make this movie because I was scared shitless. I think that's the crux of it. I didn't understand what AI was. I didn't understand why everyone was talking about it and why it seemed to be this thing that came out of the woodwork. And all of a sudden it was, people were talking about it like it was the apocalypse or like it was going to be the most optimistic, greatest thing ever. And it made me really nervous. And I had a group of colleagues who I think were also feeling very nervous. And we decided that the best power we had in our own little sphere of influence was to make a film about it. That's what we knew how to do. And that's what motivated us to go on the journey. And we very specifically had the goals of wanting to make something that that was kind of like a first date with AI for people who are maybe not tuned in, who don't follow this too closely. What is AI? Why is it good? Why is it bad? How can we maybe mitigate the bad and maximize the good? And how should people be thinking about this moment, both as it pertains to their own lives and also the historic context?
This is, it's something we cover in Engadget quite a bit, and it is wild how every day, even within the day, entire companies can shift. There's always a shifting narrative here. It changes so quickly. Has anything happened after you finished the film, produced the film, that you found to be pretty notable and maybe made you rethink certain things about your thoughts around AI?
I mean, as you alluded to, every few hours, something's happening that makes me rethink my thoughts on AI. I think the biggest single example was the Anthropic OpenAI Pentagon fiasco, where for the first time we sort of saw a line in the sand being drawn and red lines being thrown down, and Sam Altman very publicly supporting his colleagues at Anthropic for the greater good, and then very privately negotiating a backdoor deal. A slippery and slimy maneuver, which invokes to me, I think it was Paul Graham. Is that the Y Combinator guy who famously quipped that if you airdropped Sam Altman on Cannibal Island within a month, he would be the king of the cannibals. And that was a notable event. It was very disconcerting and uncomfortable. And I think for many people, it went unnoticed largely because the war in Iran started shortly thereafter. But it was something that I glommed onto, and sort of felt like, okay, this is one of those headlines that, is not good.
It's funny you bring up the Paul Graham quote because, he brought it up as a good thing, right? When a normal human hears that sentence, you're like, oh my God, what a monster that guy must be. But to Paul Graham and a lot of these Silicon Valley types, they're like, well, that's a leader. That's somebody who we actually want to lead our, multi-billion dollar investments. In your conversations,
why would Paul Graham use cannibals then? Because cannibals are like, they eat people for breakfast. Mm-hmm. It's weird if that's meant as a positive. I can think of a different metaphor. I'll take you at your word there.
Yeah, these Silicon Valley types, having covered them for a very long time, they live on a different plane of reality from us. And I think you kind of started getting at that in your interviews, like the dichotomy between the true believers of AI and the researchers and the critics who are trying to think a little more deeply around this technology too. So yeah, I'm not too surprised there. In your conversations with Sam Altman and a lot of these folks, did you Did it reveal anything to you? Like, do you think they actually have a clear sense of where they're leading this industry, or is it just kind of flying by the pants? Because I'll tell you, in our reporting of OpenAI, these guys do not seem very smart. They don't seem like they have an actual clear vision. It seems like they stumbled into this technology, and now they're just trying to scramble to stay at the top of the pack.
Yeah, I mean, I think Sam Altman's great genius was discovering Ilya Sutskever. Mm-hmm. That's the crux of it. Sam is a genius businessman, perhaps, and like the Steve Jobs at the moment, but Sutskever is the Einstein. You know, he's the true genius and the true brain behind it. In regards to, you know, my feelings on the CEOs, it's like, yeah, Sam Altman is trying very hard to be like normal and to be like a regular, accessible person. But he's the king of the cannibals, like in his heart. Like, I describe Demis at Google as like quite a lovely, thoughtful guy. And if I could wave a magic wand and put one human being in charge of the whole thing, it probably would be him, because he's so thoughtful and sweet and unassuming and just seemingly down to earth. Demis would be in second place. And then of the men I met, Sam would be in third, only because he has the air of someone who like came out of the womb and then, it, you know, thanked the doctor, handed him a 20, and then walked on stage to give his keynote address at some tech conference. That's his energy and his sensibility. And no, of course, these guys don't have a clear vision of what this is. This is very much shooting fish in a barrel kind of experiment. Let's just see what happens. Let's see how this goes. And that obviously is scary when the test subjects seemingly are the rest of us in our collective future.
Yeah, it's funny how that's working in Silicon Valley. there's a lot of moving fast and breaking all the rules and just trying to basically, you know, sweep up the market share they can after everything falls apart a little bit, I guess. Were there any topics you wanted to cover in this film that didn't make it in? Because I know there are people you wanted to talk to. You wanted to talk to Elon Musk, and he said yes, but never showed up. Were there any missing bits that you really are sad we didn't get to see in this film?
Yeah, I suppose. Look, making a film about AI that has to be 95 minutes is kind of like a suicide run.
Oh, yeah.
Like it's kind of like an impossible mission, and we sort of knew that going into it. And at the end of the day, you know, we sort of understood that. There's been a criticism of the film to that effect, like, oh, it's too much of a cursory overview. It doesn't go deep enough. And, you know, my response is, yeah, I know, but it's, again, 95 minutes is a time constraint. The intention of the movie is that it's supposed to be like a first date with the subject for, like, you know, the moms and dads out there who may not be following it as closely as you or I are. Mm-hmm. How can we take someone who's not technologically savvy, who has a very cursory understanding of how technology functions in the real world, and make this accessible for them? That was really our goal with this. There was plenty of stuff that we wish we could have put in there, geopolitical stuff, interviews with other people. We wish we could have found, you know, lab leaders in China or people from China to speak. That was sort of a non-starter and impossible. And that was very, you know, obviously disappointing. We made the best version of the film we could with the resources we had, knowing from the beginning that we were like, you know, jumping out of an airplane, stitching together the parachute as we were free fall. Which is a very challenging, stressful, but invigorating creative exercise.
I hear you. And I could tell that like the anxieties you were feeling from this film around this topic felt real, because it's something I think we're all thinking about. I had kids, you know, recently too. My oldest is 7. My youngest is just turning 4. And I think of the film Paul Schrader's First Reformed, which is, I think, one of the best explorations, like bringing a child into this world that is clearly falling apart. And we're all just trying to deal with that. And it seems like a very hard thing to do. So I appreciate like what you actually fit in here. Is AI a topic you think you'll come back to eventually? Because there is so much here. I feel like there just needs to be a constant look at what this industry is up to and kind of where they're succeeding and where they're failing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like AI, it's like, you know, it's like a gargantuan subject, like outer space or the deep sea or the Bible or like Islam or like the Chinese history. It's like, how can you possibly take something so vast and surmise into something so succinct? And that was sort of the suicide run of the movie and the challenge of the movie. And will I revisit it? Yeah, I think so, in different ways, in different modes. You know, I'd be interested in exploring a fiction project that hints on some of the themes and ideas I covered making the documentary. But right now I need a breather because this movie was not fun to make.
It does seem like this is a really hard thing for you in particular. Like, I noticed this when I'm reporting on a big topic too. There's so many different threads. People are saying so many different things. And this feels like a different film for you because you've done, you know, historical topics. You've had topics where it's like one person following their perspective and the main story around them. What was it like just to take all these different threads, different people talking about AI, and turn it into a narrative?
It was hellish. I mean, look, we had hundreds of hours, hundreds and hundreds of hours of interviews, if not, hundreds, thousands of pages of transcripts, tens of thousands of pages of transcripts, maybe. And so what do you do with that? It was a really incredible creative exercise. It was very challenging. And I don't know how we did it. I think I was so scarred by the process that I blocked some of it out. But at the end of the day, we understood how vital and important this was. And we sort of thought, my colleagues and I, that, like, you know, this is a pretty elite, you know, special forces filmmaking team who can come together to do this. And so why not give it a go, even though it feels impossible? If I knew how hard it was going to be at the beginning, I might've had the sense to say no and walk away, but I'm glad that I didn't, because I think that this film is an important document, not just for now, but for later. And it's interesting to make a film going into it knowing you can't possibly get it right. You know, you can try your best, but there's no getting it right. Let's say there's always going to be people for such a polarizing subject that don't like something, or that take issue with an element of it, or an aspect or perspective or POV, but you just sort of had to, like, pick up your bootstraps and try your best and get it done, because we thought that this was a net benefit, especially for people who are not well versed in the subject.
For sure. There was another AI documentary at Sundance this year, Ghost in the Machine, which was also, it took a very specific angle, like tying eugenics into Silicon Valley. I would love to see you sort of explore that as well, because these AI proponents, when they're talking about it's going to make a utopia for humanity, the real question is, it's a utopia for who? And I'd really love Sam Altman and some of those other folks to really make that clear, who they see would actually benefit from this. I feel like we don't always get that from them in interviews and stuff.
Fair enough. Yeah, I haven't seen that other film. I don't remember the filmmaker's name, but we were on a panel together, and she seemed like a very, very nice person, and I look forward to seeing her film. But yeah, like I said, there's 100,000 different things that we could have put in this movie, but we had a very specific mission and trajectory in mind, and we tried to be pretty laser-focused on what we want to achieve.
Can you break down the idea of being an apocaloptimist and kind of how you're bringing that into the future? Because that is something, I love the title. That's a great way to get people onto this topic. And honestly, like, since I've been covering tech, which has been a while now, I've always considered myself kind of a skeptical optimist. And I feel like it's a similar thing, right? You have to have hope for the future, but you also have to be clear-eyed about it and skeptical. Yeah.
Starting as skeptical. Yeah. I think that that's right. You know, an apocalyptimist is a way of life. It's a worldview. It's choosing not to buy into a binary that's asking us to see this as either the apocalypse and the end of the world, or through the rose-colored glasses of unvarnished optimism, which is also sort of a fallacy. It's the apocalyptimist's challenge is to hold the nuance in multitudes. It's both at the same time. For any technology that has a net positive, it has the equal and opposite negative. And that's certainly true with AI. And so, you know, you can call it a skeptical optimist or something like this, but at the end of the day, this is just an individual. An apocaloptimist is just someone who thinks critically and thoughtfully about how technology, the role technology, or in this case, artificial intelligence, plays in their lives, and tries to refuse the cynicism that so many carry, that we're doomed or we're fucked or, you know, the end is already here, to instead say, you know, we still do have agency over this, and truly believing that, you know. I'm disheartened when you read reviews about the films or comments about the films where people are just like, oh, we're fucked.
Yeah.
You know, if the only takeaway people have from the movie is, like, just don't be a cynical asshole, which very much mirrors the sort of arc of my character in the film. You know, to me, that's fine. To me, that's a good thing. But, you know, it's very, very tricky. And I understand that a lot of people have been worn down by the craziness of the last 15 years.
Yeah, Yeah. I mean, I think it's a, is it a worldview you're taking into the future for anything else? I feel like it is.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's everything. It's like, you know, I feel like trying to be grounded and thoughtful and real, but ultimately optimistic is pivotal. It's very important. And especially, you know, you mentioned you have a 4 and a 7 year old.
Yep.
I have a 2 year old, a 2.5 year old now. And it's like, sort of like nihilism and cynicism is no longer an option for my life. And, you know, the folks who watch the movie and their takeaway is we're fucked. You know, this movie's stupid. There's no hope. There's nothing to do. You know, I hope those people don't have children because it's really hard to harbor those feelings about the future if you have young kids, because young kids are nothing but joy and optimism and potential in the same way that you plant a little seed and it grows into a big tree. But at the end of the day, you know, my worldview, I think, has always been choosing to frame things through a glass half full. And I've always appreciated the beauty in the world and found the world broadly to be much more welcoming and friendly than we might think. As I've traveled to different continents and countries. So yeah, absolutely. The apocalyptic is a is a worldview I will carry forward into the future.
Awesome. I mean, I do think like there is justification for it. Just in the last couple of weeks of news around the AI industry, it's not really looking good. I think people need to pay attention to that, right? Like they like to sell this idea of inevitability, but it's not quite there. Microsoft is walking back a lot of their AI integrations in Windows. OpenAI killed Sora, which was that AI video generation app. Like these things are not certain. And the criticism, I think, is really making a difference here. So I'm glad your film is out here kind of pointing that out to people.
I appreciate it. And I think that's that is like a tangible net benefit. I think people saw Sora and was like, what the fuck is this? Are you guys lunatics?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Well, what are you doing? How irresponsible is this? You know, I can just take some like a classmate and put them in any context and it's photo like, are you guys deranged? You're just releasing this without any thoughtfulness of the negative implications, let alone the intellectual property questions and stealing from artists.
Yeah.
You know, I think that there was a backlash. I think people were uncomfortable by it and good. And both shame on OpenAI for releasing this thing without any thoughtfulness. And you know, I guess the low bar of like, at least you had the decency to pull back and retract it, but only after public condemnation. And that's what has to happen. That's why, you know, to the cynical people who are like, we're all fucked. I'm like, no, fuck you, we're not. You know, collective action matters. And I am certainly feeling much more than I was 2.5 years ago when we started this film, that this is in the ether. People are scared. People are worried. People are seeking this film out, trying to understand through films like this and other films and books and podcasts and articles, just exactly what's going on here. And I'm heartened by that.
Excellent. Excellent. And I have to ask you, because you have this like really tantalizing note in your film. You asked Elon Musk to appear. He said yes, and he never got back to you guys. Did you ever hear back from him? And can you give us a sense of like just what you were interested in asking him?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was interested in asking him the same thing I asked all the other CEOs. It's like, what's the plan here? What's the end game? What are you really trying to achieve? Who's to benefit from all of this? You know, ultimately, the CEO part of the movie for me is one of the most unsatisfying parts of the film, because, you know, there's no way you're going to talk to those guys and you're going to get satisfying responses or answers or clarity because they don't have clarity. Yeah. And that's ultimately kind of like the disappointment of the whole thing. You kind of like reach the mountaintop and you're talking to the guys and they're like, yeah, we don't know. We're just like, let's just iterate and launch these things into the world and hope they go okay. And yeah, there's sort of a red button. We know who to call if there's a problem. You know, it's like, really, that's it? You don't even have anything more than that? You know, or you talk to Dario, who's like, yeah, it's like high school. You know, you like some people, that guy's smart, quiet, that kid's a bully. Like, you know, you stay away from him. You know, that kid you don't trust. And I'm sitting here being like, are you fucking kidding me? You think about this in your own head like we're in high school? Like, that's how you think about this?
Yeah.
Oh, fuck. That is an insight into just how kind of a shrug this whole thing is. It's like, yeah, we're just trying our best. You know, we'll see how this goes. And that to me is uncomfortable. But people have pointed out, yeah, the CEO section of the film is unsatisfying. And I totally agree. It's because these guys
Yes.
You know, when you actually sit down with them, they're like, they don't have clarity. They can't make you feel better. They don't know themselves. They're just motivated by the unbridled optimism of the greatest profit-making thing, technology, in the history of humanity. And as we know from Silicon Valley, framing is through the lens of well-being and putting human beings first and foremost has not been the historical precedence.
Yeah, introspection hasn't been their strong suit. I don't know if you've seen the comments by Marc Andreessen, who's a big Silicon Valley investor as well, who doesn't believe there is an inner life, who doesn't believe like anything is going on inside your head, really. And I think that really reveals how a lot of these people talk.
They're just weird. They're just weird. They're just like autistic nerds who became billionaires because they were born at the right time and they had the right interests and they're brilliant in their own way and they have abilities. But they don't understand what it is to exist. They don't understand what real human beings navigate and go through. They have a very narrow worldview that's callous and cold and calculated. And it's sort of like, I just was so struck. Like, you know, these guys are like, they all have Asperger's. They're all on the spectrum. And it's like, oh, you're the people who are building this thing that's going to change the world and facilitate how we communicate and interact and yada, yada, yada. I'm like, that is telling, you know, the Marc Andreessens of the world. Like, I just find it like kind of yucky. I don't know how else to describe it. It's like, a billionaire guy saying that we don't have an interior life. It's like, oh my God, you're so fucking annoying. Like, that's just so obnoxious to like a regular person like me. I don't really know what else to say or how to address it.
I mean, I hear you, but you look at like the state of the social media companies, it's the same thing, right? It's Zuckerberg building these platforms for communication for guys that have no idea how to talk to other human beings. So it's no wonder it all became a shit show.
I'm glad that those fucking guys, this week with this landmark ruling, we had for the first time an AI company, or a technology company, a social media company that is being held liable for damages. For the negative use cases of their products, of which there are ample amounts. Good. Let these guys be held civilly responsible. Okay. Let's have that happen in Canada and Australia and New Zealand and across Europe and across, the entire world, because these guys need to be responsible for the products that they create. And it can't just be this oopsie daisies thing. Oh, sorry. You know, we didn't know that they were planning a genocide on our platform. And proliferating disinformation, in Rohingya, like, oops. It's like, no, fuck off. You have to take responsibility for the shit you build. And you can't just hide behind your fancy offices and your, douchebag tech bro sunglasses.
Daniel, I could keep talking about this forever, I feel like, but I know you have a movie to make. You've a child to take care of. So I just want to leave it right there. What are you working on right now? Where can people find your work in the future?
Well, right now, I have a film coming out in May called Tuner, which is a fun little heist film, which is a really good palate cleanser, I think, for the AI documentary. One is very intense and the other is kind of fun and romantic and jazzy. And then my new film, I'm shooting in May, it starts in May, and it's like a con man caper film set in Italy that stars Matthew McConaughey and Zoe Saldana.
Oh, wow.
And I'm excited about that one. Another, just like fun movie, good counter programming to the shit show that is life right now.
I hear you. Thank you so much, Daniel, for chatting with us.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for your interest. And I hope everyone enjoys the film, if it's possible to enjoy a film like this.